Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, this is episode 5 now.
Episode many.
Episode 2 bloody many. Don't even know what bloody day it is anymore. Have you got to that? You just kind of don't have a clue what day it is.
I'm sort of planning my days. I know what day it is by the day that I have a drink. I'm having a drink on sort of Friday nights.
Right, mine's Saturday, so yeah, kind of the same again.
When I have a drink, I'm like, right, okay, I know what day it is now.
It's Saturday, Friday.
It's so weird, isn't it? Yeah. Strange. But I guess these podcasts that we've been doing, it's made so much easier now that we've been able to do them on Zoom and Skype and stuff.
Yeah, can I just say, like, this is Zoom now. When we speak to our guest Shane Meadows, we recorded on Skype, but
yeah, we've moved up in the world now, haven't we? We've gone on to bigger things.
I didn't want Zoom. I didn't embrace the change, but my God, I love this. I love it. It's so good to podcast.
Anything change? I don't like change. It unsettles me.
Yeah, I think it was David, wasn't it, who did change, wasn't it?
Who?
David.
David Allen. David Allen. Change, yeah, that was a subject.
Yeah,
in general, just anything, sort of like, you get so used to something, don't you? And then it's like, bang, then it's changed. But
like being able to go outside your house. You get
like being able to go outside your house.
And then all of a sudden,
bang. No, but it's given us, it's sort of a great opportunity for us to get a lot of the guests that we've been planning on getting for a long time. And now, obviously, down to scheduling a lot. The guests that we've been wanting to get on are sort of available now. So we're quite fortunate, and which is, you know, the great guest that we've been able to bring you today's, obviously, Shane Meadows, was one that we, you know, along with Stephen Graham and Shane Meadows, because when we started the podcast, we did say that we don't want it to be a This Is England podcast, and that's not what it is. Yeah. You know, it's just, obviously, we was in it together a long time ago, but, you know, we've sort of opened lots of other doors with different guests and things like that. But at the end of the day, people like Shane and Stephen and Vicky McClure and all these people are our really close friends, and it just so happens that, you know, that we was in This Is England together, so it makes sense that we get all them on. Yeah, but Shane was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, the listeners will hear in a minute, but it's one of them rare ones where me and you hardly do any work and we just sit and enthralled to what Shane's saying, really, isn't it? Which is nice.
Yeah, he's got that ability, hasn't he, where he doesn't do it on purpose, but when he starts to tell a story, everyone around him can just sort of get sucked into what he's saying, which is why I guess he's such a great writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's great storyteller, isn't he, I guess. And you know, we had him on with a few subjects, as a lot of our guests seem to nowadays. It seems like everybody's got a few, which is great. I love it.
Yeah. But we've had some really, really good ones. Like we've got a massive back catalogue now of episodes recorded and ready to go out. And some of the subjects have been fucking mint.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, Shane's main subject, as you've clicked the link, so you'll know, as we always say, is full sleeves tattoos.
Yeah.
It was a strange one because, obviously, you know, This Is England, very, you know, we've all, well, that's a big thing.
You got it. I didn't. My dad won't let me.
Which we say in this, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously Shane wasn't talking about just, you know, tattoos in general. He was, you know, listen to it, basically. We won't spoil it. But that was good. he talks a bit about how adults speak to children.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah.
And then making adverts for telly, which a lot of our listeners won't really have much input on, I guess, unless you're a director or...
I mean, I'm the opposite when it comes to commercials, because they pay very fucking well.
They do. They
when a commercial comes in for me, I'm like, yeah, I can do that for a day. Yeah, fucking right, I can. But I guess for a creative director like Shane, it might be a bit...
bit different.
Like he touches on in the chat, he likes to have full control over what's going on.
Yeah.
Down to the edit, to the score, to the soundtrack and everything. So I guess when you've got, you know, these big corporate companies behind their brand, it's a bit different. Normally Shane's making content for his own brand, isn't he? You know, his own stories. So yeah, it was a great chat. It's probably, again, I know we say it all the time, but probably one of my favourite.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like say, you know, we've been, obviously we've known Shane, luckily, lucky to have known Shane for like 15 years this year, is it, since we did the film, 2005?
Well, it was, this is England's 13th birthday the other day, wasn't it?
Yeah, but we filmed it.
Well, we filmed it a year before or something. So yeah,
2005 we filmed it. So yeah, 15 years this year, man.
Mm.
Feel old, Tomo. Feel old.
I know. I feel the older, the longer this lockdown goes on, the older I feel.
Definitely. Well, let's keep everyone entertained on the lockdown. And here's Shane Meadows.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Righty ho. Right, okay. Tom, do you want to introduce?
Yes. Yeah, here we are again. God, I lose track of what weeks we're on now.
You've done 25, Tom.
Have we done 25? Is that how many are released now? I know we've been busy recording more recently.
I think I went on Spotify. There was, I think there was 20. I think it was 25. Yeah.
That, 25. That yeah,
something so, like that. And then, because now we're on series two, so I've changed it now. So this might be at, say, I don't know, let's say four for good measure.
God, yeah, I'm not
yeah, a bit more forward planning wouldn't have gone amiss.
And I know, like, yeah.
All the time that we've got, I guess we're just all like,
we've just been saying, we've just been so busy, like, doing the garden and like my house is absolutely gleaming, spotless at the minute with everything that's going on. So I guess it's kind of finding the good in it. But how are you doing, Shane?
Yes, I'm good, mate. Yeah, I mean, I was, I mean, I've got a lot of friends, as I, you know, yourself included, and a lot of crew who were just, you know, some had had really lean Christmas, lean winters, and had just got back into work, who had their jobs pulled from under them. And, you know, obviously, you know, there's plenty of people with far more to worry about than just, you know, not having work for a while. But, you know, it's I'm in our game, Tom. I'm one of the luckier ones. I was just in the middle of, and I'm in the middle of writing a series, you know, which is obviously like self-isolation before you even go anywhere. So, yeah, you know, I've got the same thing as a lot of parents. You know, the kids suddenly becoming a teacher at home for a number of hours a day, everyone being trapped in the house together and all of that. But you see what's going on to other people and hear other stories. And, you know, obviously it pales by comparison, and you just got to crack on, do your bit. And anyone that comes past me too near on their pushback, I just slap their arse.
How are you finding the homeschooling, mate? How are you finding all that?
Not too bad. I said, like, I did this really stupid thing of telling my kids, because I got 91%, because my kids had found some reports that I had when I was at school, and, you know, they're not good. They're sort of like Ted Bundy style, you know, really worrying. And so I sort of said, yeah, but I was really good at maths and that, but, you know, and I got 91% in this test. But it was like I was in a really low group. And I think, you know, it was one of those kind of mercy scores. But I lived on them, you know, and I sort of, so I pretended to them that I was much better at maths than I was. And so they came to me with all these problems and that. And I think I'd sort of pretended I'd slipped a disc and couldn't quite remember the phrasing, went for a 3-mile walk, and like, and I had to learn all about it. But I'm getting into it now. And I kind of, my lad's got he had a drum kit for his birthday. And and so we're doing like a little music lesson once a week and doing the maths. But I can't lie, my wife's doing, you know, the English and a lot of the stuff like that. You know, it's been so, you know, I'm doing that classic father thing of doing 15% or maybe 2% and then making out I've done really well.
Oh, it's kind of nice, though, to spend all the time with your family. Like for me, I haven't got obviously, as people know, I haven't got kids, but Andy, you've got two, haven't you? And you've got two, haven't you, Shane?
I've got two, mate. Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's kind of a treat.
Sorry.
I was going to say, I can't believe you're on two, because the mad thing for me is, obviously, we, you know, I started working with you, Tom, when you were two and Gadget was 15. And it's really mental, you know, because obviously I had kids a bit later in life. So it's crazy for me to, to think that all of the guys from, you know, the original This Is England film starting to have kids, and I know you're married in that, T. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's mental. Yeah, Andy told me yesterday in a conversation, he was like, he said, I was 24 when he had Phoebe, his first one, and I was like, 24? Oh, my God. And then I thought back and I thought, what was I doing when I was 24? And I was like, oh, God, it's not even worth thinking about.
I know. My mum had my sister when she was 16. I mean, 24 then was probably old. But nowadays, it seems so young, doesn't it, how much things have changed.
Yeah. But I'm saying my mum was 18 when she had me, and her mum was 18 when she had her. So I always kind of thought I'd have kids young. But yeah, but it's one of them, isn't it? Like, Tomo, now you probably don't feel ready. Like, I don't think you ever do feel ready, do you, Shane? It's one of them. It's just kind of like, oh, right, okay.
When it lands. Yeah, it is one of them in equal measures. It's like a massive slap round the face, because I was much worse at staying awake than I realised. But then, yeah, you know, it's obviously a life changer, and you don't have to do it, Tom, but I can't wait for you to do it so I can ring you in that first 6 weeks.
No, it's one of them. Like, because me and Charlotte, we've been together for, God, coming on 11 years now. I think me and Charlotte have been together.
Jesus.
We're in our second year of marriage now. So, but people always say, like, because we've got a big friendship group, people are always saying, you know, say if my mate Josh has a baby, everyone will go, oh, Charlotte and Tomo next. And we're like, no, not yet. But it's been like that for years. Everyone's saying, oh, you two next. But I think we, in a way, I guess we're kind of a bit too selfish in a way, because we enjoy our time. We love being out, particularly with our job. It's like, say if I'm away working or whatever, Charlotte can just, she can get in the car on a Friday afternoon after work and come see me, and, you know, we can go out and have some fun and we can do whatever we want. Whereas if we had kids, it'd be like you sort of your whole life changes and it evolves around them, which is obviously a good thing. And like you'll then learn to have fun in other ways. But it's kind of like it's a scary thing, really. I don't know. It's a big lifestyle change, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is, mate. And you're young enough. I mean, you know, me and Joe didn't have kids till we were in our sort of mid-30s, you know, and you do it two ways. I think my mum and dad did it really young. So by the time I think my sister was sort of 13 or 14, she could babysit for me. And they were, so by the time my sister was 13, my mum would have been like 29. So she was like able to go back out again with a babysitter at 29. It's just like, you know, but I suppose, you know, I think do it early or do it late, and you know, it can work both ways. But you definitely, you know, if you're enjoying your time together now, do, don't.
Yeah, that's it. We'll be cruise ship parents by the time our kids are 18. Like, yeah, we'll be past all of the traveling around Thailand and things like that. We'll just be like, let's go on a cruise. Let's just do a cruise, kind of a chilled holiday. But yeah, I think, I don't know. We're nearly 30 now, so maybe in the next couple of years, I think.
Yeah, it'll come, and it just kind of comes from nowhere. And when it does, it is obviously the most amazing thing. And but yeah, you're much better to have some idea you fancy it.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? And Charlotte, because she's she runs a nursery in Cleethorpes, and she's worked with children since she was 17. She's been at that nursery, so I literally couldn't think of a better person to have kids with. She's so good with kids, so
yeah,
I guess I'm kind of lucky in aspects. And she makes a cracking Sunday roast, so yeah, I've kind of landed on my feet really there.
Yeah, you're doing amazing, mate.
Yeah, that's it. But
while we're on kids, then we may as well go on to, because Jane, you've got a few subjects for us, which I love that you've got a few.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Great subjects.
I don't know what the title of the episode's going to be yet. I guess it depends which one goes on the longest.
But it'll be the adverts that go on the longest. But
all right, brilliant. Well, let's kick off then. As soon as we're talking about kids, with the first one, because me and Tomo, we didn't know what you meant by it. I kind of thought, do you mean like when people sort of baby the kids? Like I'm not like that. You know, like I kind of speak to Phoebe like not like an adult, but I don't treat her like a baby.
Yeah.
And then Tomo said you didn't know whether you meant, you know, people who shout at the kids in the supermarket or whatever. So it's kids. So our parents talk to kids under 7.
Yeah. So basically, I was, you know, obviously you have kids and you go to the park and you have this idea in your own head that obviously I'm a bit like you. You know, you sort of, basically when people speak to kids under 7, they always seem to have a really posh name. Like there's like, there might be 3 or 4, they might have bought their friends from down the road, and there's like 2 mums or, you know, a whole family, and then all these little kids there, and you'd hear them calling out, you know, look, Rufus, don't take that train off Limmy, you know. And I'd start hearing this stuff coming out of people's mouths, and I hated them. And I was sort of thinking, God almighty, you know, wherever we went, you go to visit, like, you know, some like farm or something with the kids, and just the way that you hear parents talking, and you sort of, they're looking at people thinking, God, I bet 30 seconds before your baby was born, you'd probably spew up if you heard yourself talking like this. And this amazing thing happened where obviously you start watching videos about one of your kids, and I'm doing it myself. And I'm like, Arthur, stay away from Louis, and he doesn't deserve that right now. Look at yourself, young man. And I'm just like, oh, fuck. This is like a disease that everyone catches. And I was judging all of these people for the way that they talk to their kids. Because people say you become your parents, but it's like worse than that. You become an absolute twat. And I don't, not even in a mean way, where you're trying to be all kind of kind and nice and judging everyone's feelings, and you just sound like an absolute jerk ball. That was just one of my little ones that was, I was going around prejudging people at various parks and entertainment centres around the country, and then heard myself on video doing exactly the same and wanted to throw up in my mouth.
It is hard though, isn't it? Because like, I guess even like my mum, like obviously we're different generations, my mum would have spoke to me completely different to how parents do speak to the kids nowadays. Like, you know, because there is a lot of that, like you say, nowadays there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, how the children are feeling. Yeah. and stuff, I guess, and stuff like that. But I did it yesterday. I was in the back garden with Phoebe, and we took her stabilizers off a bike for the first time.
Oh, amazing. So
Yeah, so we've got a fairly decent sized back garden, so I'm going to give it a go trying to teach her while we're doing quarantine. But I found myself turning into that kind of that dad that I, you know, used to watch on TV. Like, I'd never be him. I was like, come on, Phoebe, you can do it. Just lift and push. And, you know, just like, sounding like Mr. Motivator or something, trying to get her to ride a bike.
It's because it's kind of what you're meant to be doing. I think it's the fact that when you hear it from someone else and you haven't got the perspective of being a parent, you kind of judge them. I mean, honestly, early doors, because, you know, my wife has been incredible, and she's really meticulous with, and rightly so, with bugs and all of that. So, and I'm quite an inherently lazy pig. And so when we were doing the sterilizing in the house, we had this sterilizer. And when our Artie was born, he had this tongue tie thing, and he couldn't eat properly because he had this really thick tongue tie, and he couldn't eat from a bottle. So you have to feed him with syringes. And we used to end up with about 13 times more bits and pieces to sterilize. And so Joe obviously told me, you know, I had to go through like rigorous training to learn how to do it. And I was told there was a limit to what could go into this pot. And it's like, you know, four bottles, four lids, and, you know, and four teats, or you can have, you know, three. So, and a couple of times in the night, Joe would go to bed because he had this tongue tie, so he had awful colic and was crying and couldn't eat but was hungry. Wow. And so you've got these, so he wouldn't sleep sitting down. So I used to have to stand up holding him. Well, and I would watch Boone, because Boone was running throughout the night on like UK Gold, Ken Boone. And then you'd go to sit down and he'd cry, and I'd be so knackered. So when I went in to do these chores, there'd be like 376 things and one container. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be here for about 4 hours having to do them in the way that I've been trained. So because she's asleep, I'll add a few extra bits in. Then I couldn't find the sterilizing lotion either. So I got some fairy washing up liquid, and literally scientists with machines couldn't get as much into that thing as I got into it. It was like, it was literally like a cage with animals' faces pressed against the side of it, all dying. And I put it in the microwave, and then I was watching the microwave, and it obviously wasn't facing the door. I wasn't able to see what was going on behind me. And then as this ping happened, I could feel this presence behind me. And it was one of those where it's in there, and she was kind of, I can't remember what it was, but it was along the lines of, show me what you've done. And I got this thing. It was all like bubbles and suds and 14 million melted plastic items in this pot. And I got caught red-handed. And then, yeah, I did a number of things like that, mate. And it's like, you know, I'm inherently of a 70s and 80s kind of mode. And obviously, Joe does everything properly. And I appear to be doing everything properly. But where I can get away with it, I do risk everyone's health.
Go on. I was going to say, there is a lot to learn, though, Shane. So you're not on your own. We've all cut corners with stuff like that. Because, like, the sterilizing thing, I've never fully understood either. So, because after a certain age, you can kind of lower, stop doing it, can't you? And
you can. Yeah, and it obviously, it's one of those things that it's designed to do a certain amount of things so the steam can circulate. So if you fill it with 99.9% plastic, there's like 0.1% for steam to get around. So she's got a sixth sense for that stuff. I tried to sneak out with him once because he wouldn't sleep, because I know he sleeps in the car. And she'd gone to bed, and I gave it an hour. I watched an episode of Boone. And then after an hour of that, I thought, there's no, you know, she's going to be flat out now. And I snuck out the door. I opened the door, left it slightly ajar, went to the car. I was going to put me in the child seat. And there was a knock at the window above. It was like something from Psycho. And I looked up, and she was just stood in the window with a finger, like, as in going, come back into the house. The scariest thing I've ever done in my life. And,
it was like a top mission. Balls.
Yeah. So there's me kind of going around judging all these parents, you know, like, Philip, leave Sally alone, you know, all of that malarkey. I was the worst of them.
Oh, my God. That's it. That whole thing about the whole sterilizing things, like,
that scares me, things like that, because I'm exactly the same. And the way Andy worded it, he said like cutting corners, I'd think, I mean, what's the worst that can happen? And next thing, your baby's turning into a lizard. I'm like,
it's one of them, though. You get used to it fairly quick. I remember when my second was born, Willow, I was working away at the time. So I was like coming home on the weekends and stuff as much as possible. And I remember coming home like sort of the second or third weekend. And because I'm away during the week, my house had just completely changed. It had gone from being a house with a toddler, not a toddler, a house with a young child, to a house with a baby again. And I just remember coming home one weekend and like kind of semi breaking down to Emily, like, I don't know where anything is in the house anymore.
Yeah. Oh, mate.
My kitchen side's full of, like you say, sterilizing machines and a special kind of kettle that we can't use. That's just for the baby and all stuff like that. I'm just like, what's going on?
And did you like me sort of wonder how on earth you ever grew up with your eyes still seeing out of them? Because as soon as my kids started walking about, you suddenly see sharp edges and all of these, like the house becomes like a sort of murder zone. You have to put all the things in to stop knife drawers being. I'm sort of thinking, none of that existed when I was a kid. I remember Paddy Considine saying to me that, you know, because one of his sisters had quite a lot of kids, and he said that they were so adept at not hurting themselves, you know, that they'd like, there could be a glass full of flaws and needles and sharp edges, and they'd manage to walk across it without a cut. And I think sometimes if you massively go the other way and you completely remove all danger, it's like if there's one sharp edge in the old house, they seem to bang their head on it.
Always. It's the same. Like with Willow now, because we had it quite all right with Phoebe. I can't really remember her being as kind of adventurous and you know. But with Willow, she's literally, if there's something she shouldn't be doing, she's doing it. You know, we've got like a log feature in the fireplace kind of thing, and she's like pulling logs out of that. And we've got like a little. We went to, on our honeymoon, we went to the Grand Canyon and stuff. And I nicked like a little rock from the Grand Canyon. So that's on like our
nice
side unit. And I found her the other day chewing on this, you know, ancient bit. Like, no.
But that's a scary thing. That's a scary thing, isn't it? But I kind of like, now I'm sitting here thinking, I've had none of that. I've had nothing to worry about that.
Scrunch, the Tiger King and that, can't you? And just put your feet
I've not seen that yet. So people keep mentioning it, but have you seen it, Shane?
Yeah, it's like, you know, Keith Lemon playing Mark in America running a zoo. It's absolutely incredible.
Playing Mark Herbert.
Yeah, it's like, or Mark playing Keith Lemon the other way, but it, you can't believe it's real. I mean, it's absolutely gobsmacking. Because
I watched the first step and it's crazy.
Have you seen Wild Country on Netflix?
Wild Country?
No.
That was amazing. Because it's like it was about this this kind of guru that came to set up almost like a meditation type center with its own philosophy, almost like a religion that he bought to America. He bought this piece of scrubland. I can't remember whether it was Arizona or somewhere, but this story sort of starts as something you can get your head around, and then, you know, 3 months into it, the people in the town obviously don't really like them being there. And 3 months later, they've all voted in the elections, made him the mayor. And they're all wearing pink suits with machine guns and have changed all the rules. It's like absolutely amazing. And I never thought I'd see anything that kind of kept tripping my head as much. But the Tiger King's almost more comedic. The stuff that happens isn't actually funny. But somehow that main guy, I mean, I won't even ruin it. You know, you have to sort of see it to believe it. But yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, definitely check it out.
I keep seeing like memes all over the internet. So, I've already agreed to myself that Carol Baskin's a bitch, and I've never met her. I don't even know who she is. But because of the internet, it's like I already feel like I know who she is. You know what I mean? It's mental.
Yeah, she's incredible. She kind of, you remember like when we did the Pagan Festival, and this is England 90, and some of the girls there had those like rings of flowers in their hair and that. She kind of wears that. But what they do brilliantly in the series is they obviously start recording with people 20, 30 seconds or a minute before they sit down and, you know, and do the interview. And that's so telling, you know, because it's like how they're trying to present themselves, all sat there, all hippie chic by a tree and stuff. But the bit where they know it, yeah, it's amazing. And mate, honestly, every episode, you think it can't be any more mental than the last one. And it is.
Yeah, we started the first one the other night, and it is just brilliant. I can't wait to watch the rest. The guy who, the other big cat keeper who, like, he's trying to direct the episode, didn't he? I thought that was brilliant.
It's genius. Yeah, it's,
yeah. Just get a shot of me walking in, guys.
Got about 94 wives. The other bloke's got two husbands. Carol Baskin, we think, may have not one of her husbands. I mean, it's like day or three. Yeah, I mean, it just, what was amazing, if you know nothing else, or, you know, you learn nothing else from it, is I had no idea. I remember seeing, I think Mike Tyson had a tiger in the Hangover, or it was something around that, where there was a tiger in the room. And I had no idea that the laws were so lax in America that loads of people just have pet tigers. And obviously they have them for 6 months and they're really good mates.
Hasn't Memphis Depay, who used to play for Man United, he's just got one, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's it's like I you can basically kind of buy them. This it all started. This documentary filmmaker was doing something at some exotic animal place, and this dude come in to buy this, like, what looks like a 350-foot long python, goes to put it in the back of the van, and I think there's like a white leopard in the back of his van, and it all takes off from there, and he finds out where he got it. So the premise being that they have these bloody, they're born, these little pups are born, and then people come around his zoo, open close bracket zoo, and then once it gets to a certain age, they just get sold off. And so obviously what he's doing is cynical, but she's obviously claiming that she runs an actual sanctuary, but it's probably more scary than anyone else in it.
Mm. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Some of the things that are being made now, it's mental, isn't it? Like the whole that Making a Murderer thing was crazy on Netflix. Did anyone see that?
That broke the mold, didn't it? That it was a bit like Sopranos in TV drama terms. It just kind of went wherever you thought the level was, this is the new one. It was a watershed moment, Making a Murderer.
Yeah, it kind of changed the way that documentaries was being made, didn't it? Like, it Absolutely. Was just so ruthless, and the things that you could never imagine happening. It's just like Netflix have kind of like what Channel 4 do in a way. Channel 4 are the ones that will get all the real, like, you could never imagine This Is England being on BBC or ITV.
You know,
little bit more real and a little bit more risky, if you know what I mean.
I mean, they haven't got that sheen to them, have they? They kind of, they can be a bit more raw. And I mean, I grew up with, I remember Channel 4 launching, and I can't remember whether it, I think the first film that came on was this film called Walter with Ian McKellen. They sort of did a big launch, and Jesus, that film was heartbreaking. He played a guy with special needs, but was being, I can't remember it completely, but I think it was like in the East End of London. And the bullying, and it was like, you know, it stayed with me. And so, you know, I've always had a love affair with, especially with early Channel 4 drama. And, you know, the BBC back in the day, some of their Play for Todays and things like that were absolutely groundbreaking. You know, you hope now, like with the advent of Netflix and people like that, that it might just break the walls down a bit again and they get back to some of that more edgy stuff.
That'll kind of lead us nicely into to your next subject, I think, Shane.
Okay, yeah.
Which was the, what was it again? The second one that you said.
Oh, was it making commercials for the telly?
Mm, yeah.
Yes. Well, because I say overrated, because it's like, I obviously, when I was making my early films, you know, you don't make a lot of money. And a lot of times if you need pickups or reshoots, I mean, This Is England, me and Mark both had to put a quarter of our wages back into that to get the reshoots done. And even though it went on to sell a million DVDs, we never got that money back. And so, you know, I'm not moaning about that. You know, I needed to get the ending and stuff like that. But so I started hearing about, you know, making commercials quite early on in my career as a way of, you know, as a way of making ends meet and, you know, getting a few luxuries so I could buy an MX-5 or a Fiat Punto. And So I started doing them, and after about, I maybe did 4 or 5 one year, and they are, you know, I found them, and this is a, you know, the proviso being that I think it's all down to me that I'm like, there's something inherently in me that I just can't take shit, or I can't take fakeness. I really struggle with it. Now, obviously, if you're being paid £5,000 a day to do, I mean, when I say a day, you might do a 2-day shoot. You know, you're not doing like 50 days in a row.
Yeah.
And it's nothing compared to footballers' wages. But, you know, at the beginning of it, you kind of go, oh, for £5,000 a day, you know, I'll do anything. I'll like fiddle with it.
Like, how high do you want me to jump?
But it's like, I learned so much about myself in there that I don't have the ability I don't have the ability to lie when someone's talking out their arse, and I certainly don't have the ability to laugh when a joke isn't funny. It's like, and so, but I kind of, you get kind of drawn in where you kind of keep, you have long enough away from it that, that you sort of think, well, it wasn't that bad. And to be honest with you, I met some incredible actors across it. I met Joe Hartley in a rehearsal for an advert for the Sun newspaper, as I did Emily Aston, who were both, you know, Dead Man Shoes, you know. So, and I used to get to try cameras, new cameras, when red cameras first came out, I got to try them. So there's all of these positives.
It's a great learning curve, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, but then we did this one. I can remember Mark Herbert said to me, you know, because we'd be doing these jobs together, like Dead Man Shoes, and Mark was kind of, I was done with doing adverts, and Mark, you know, was saying to me, look, you know, we're thinking about, you know, branching out and maybe getting into commercials. And I said, stay away from it, mate. I said, it's so soul destroying. And he was like, well, how soul destroying can it be, you mighty bastard? £5,000 a day, £10,000 a day, what people are getting paid? How hard can it be? I said, honestly, something happens to you in there, you know, that something really awful. So he didn't believe me. And I didn't believe me really either. I think I'd just got to that place where I thought it might all be okay again. And we took on this job, and Mark set up a company to do these commercials. And I thought, I'll just give it, you know, one last hurrah, and Mark's going to get into them. And if I'm doing them with Mark, maybe it might be
a little bit easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we had like literally the worst job I've ever done in my life. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. I mean, it was an advert that was meant to be set in the summer, and we didn't end up shooting it until October, and it snowed. And about 10 foot of snow came down, and it was absolutely like the worst experience of my life. Mark opened up the company, and within 3 months had closed it down again.
And, oh my gosh.
Yeah, nearly had a nervous breakdown over it. And it's, so it's just a world that I got to, and I kind of realized that, you know, no amount of money, I think it come from my dad, if I'm honest. My dad's always been one of those people that if someone is in a position above you, or they think they're in a position above you, and they speak to you like shit, he just won't take it. He'll react and he'll say something, and my dad's come back sometimes from a job and he's jacked his job in. I mean, mum's obviously going spare because we've got to pay the rent, got to pay the bills and all of that. But there was always this sort of deep, actually, when you heard what had been said or what had actually gone on, that he just said, they can fucking ride, you know. Just like, I'm not having that. And I think that followed me into making commercials. And it's like, I mean, there was an incredible series called, is it The Toast of London?
Yeah, brilliant series.
Yeah, which looks into that world. And another one which is brilliant, which looks into the American system, which was Episodes with Matt LeBlanc. And
I'm obsessed with that. I love that.
Because when I first went out to America in 90, I think it was 96, 97, it would have been with 24/7 with Bob Hoskins. And I was getting that sort of treatment a bit, you know, where they just won that BAFTA and all of these people come for you and they you know, they all want a piece of you. I remember coming into my hotel room at the Toronto Film Festival. I don't think they have them anymore, but these phones, they have like a red flashing light on them. And for the first 2 days I was there, the film hadn't been screened, and, you know, you'd come in, it never was anything other than just a plain red light. And after the screening, it got this big review. And then I come back that night after this big dinner and the phone was just flashing constantly. I picked it up and pressed the answer phone thing, and I got like 32 messages, and all of this stuff started happening, you know. And I was like just about to sign a deal with some people in the UK, and all of these people start blowing smoke up your ass. And the way they handle it in Episodes, I can't remember the main dude who works at the studio with the beard and the slightly bald head, the one who always takes the piss accents. I mean, everybody was like that. But the first time round, you don't know that they're bullshitting you, or you don't know that it's just how they play the game. And so, you know, I kind of come back from America and I was having presents sent to my house, nothing crazy, but you'd mention, because I'm a right techno head, I'd mention like a Palm Pilot or some new clamshell phone that had just been launched by Motorola. And by the time I'd got home from America, that them things were at my house. And so you're thinking, so, you know, you hear all of these stories about these guys, the guy that did Judge Dredd being one of the most famous. And the guy that did, oh my God, why can't, Richard Stanley, one of the most amazing stories ever, an incredibly talented man that went to do a horror film, which was The Island of Dr. Moreau. It's one of the most heartbreaking stories ever, that truly gifted filmmaker and just got absolutely broken. And I got very close to signing a deal, a six film deal with a studio out there, and just got cold feet and kind of thought, you know, something's not right here. And backed out of it. And but, you know, when you see things like Episodes and you look at what happens to them with that series, I know that would have happened to me, because what I kind of do isn't, I suppose, you know, I can only work one way, you know, and I couldn't work under that system.
Yeah, it's more, I mean, it is a complete and utter business, especially out there, isn't it? Like, you know, I love that. Have you ever watched Entourage as well?
I've not seen Entourage. No.
It's again, that shows it from that kind of side as well, because it's all, you know, it's based on the actor and his, like,
based on Mark Wahlberg's life, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's semi based on Mark.
Yeah.
But you see that kind of thing, like you say, yeah, with the agents, like, you know, they're just relentless, the agents and the people trying to sign you up for deals and how hard it is to, you know, to get out of them deals and things like that. Like, it is a proper cutthroat business, I guess, over there.
Yeah,
we haven't quite got that yet, have we?
No, because we you know, we all agents, you know, everyone's agents have been around, you know, since the sort of entertainment industry began. But you go to you know, and I know people that work here and in America, and they've kind of got two agents, a lawyer, a publicist, and, you know, they have this massive team. You're sort of thinking, well, what if everyone's taking 10% here or 5% there,
what are you taking?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, if you need it, fair enough, but you know, all I've ever had is an agent, and that's been good. And I'm sure, like you say, maybe when you get out there, it's a completely different world. But yeah, it's absolutely frightening, and maybe a bit like what's happened in Premier League football, where once you get people in between striking the best deals, and you know, and they've got maybe two or three people in their camp, you know, it starts to get stinky.
Yeah, yeah, it can get too many. What is it? Too many chefs ruin the. What is it? It's gone now. Too many cooks spoil the broth or something.
That's it. Yeah, yeah, it is, and it's. But, it, you know, I'd never change those early days, because it was just what a thing to have done, you know, as a younger man. And I never reached the top of anything. And, you know, I never been to the Oscars, never been to the Golden Globe, never done that. But just as a, you know, because I suppose, I don't know, a year before I was out there, I mean, I was still on the dole when I went to Toronto, because I was going out. I got... they give me something, I don't know, $50 a day or $30 a day to live on, which was amazing. But when I was out there, I couldn't afford a Rolex, and I'd always wanted a Rolex ever since I was a kid. You know, the Sean Connery, James Bond thing, Marlon Brando, you know, that in Apocalypse Now, that sort of vibe. And so, I knew when you get to these places in America, like New York, Toronto, you can get these copies. And I bought this copy. And I thought, oh, I'll get my dad a tag copy, because he loves tags. And I bought this tag copy. And then I went back to the hotel and was playing pool. And this bloke went, oh, you know, nice watch, dude. And I was like, oh, it's a fakie. And he said, well, yeah, he said, no, it's not a fakie, because the hand's sweeping around. It means it's an automatic. I said, no, I had to go a bit deeper into the city. But I didn't want a ticker, because everyone knows, you know, like if it's got a battery. And he said, oh, I'd love one of them, you know, take my wife one. And so and he asked me what they cost. I think I paid $40 for mine. And I told him they were like $90. And so I went out and bought two and come back. And this thing started spreading around that this guy's getting like really good copies of Rolexes. And all of these execs from Miramax and people, they weren't going to pretend they were real, but they were just like giving them to staff. And then I started playing. And I'd be playing pool in the reception of my lobby, and like people had come in, like I was like Zamo's drug dealer in Grange Hill. And we're coming in, and like, I can have a quick word with you in the toilets, man. I'm saying, like, yeah, we can do it here. It's only a watch, and I bought all this stuff, and between that, And I used to, if ever anyone wanted a meeting, I'd always make sure it was at a meal time, so I didn't have to buy anything. It was like shimmy. You might have to shimmy before you
met. I was literally just about to say, maybe shimmy learn it all from you. Maybe shimmy is your fault.
Yeah, I took a meeting with Walt Disney once and told him that I'd got this idea for a film, because my agent said, look, I don't know why Walt Disney would see, I think it was with Romeo Brass, why Walt Disney would watch Romeo Brass and think that you'd work for Disney. I said, well, you know, let's just do the same as usual, book them in for breakfast, and I'll pretend I've got something to do about it. So I'm doing this meal, and I was thinking on the way up, what can I do? What could I come up with as an idea? And I thought in my head, well, that Herbie, they'd just re-released the, it was around the time I think they'd re-released the Beatle. And so I go to talk to them, and I sort of think, well, I'll just tell them I'm thinking about making this idea of Herbie Goes Bananas, but with ram raiding. So it like that Herbie's being used for really evil purposes, but then it ends good. And in the end, that film got made. I don't know whether they'd used the frigging ram raiding in Moss Side bit that I was joking about. But when I got back from America, they kept ringing my agent and wanted to talk to me about this idea again. And I was going, Jody, it was a joke. I was like, as if I'm going to make Herbie Goes Bananas twice. And and so that was one of those that backfired a little bit. But they, God knows why they wanted me in the room. But for some reason, I needed sausages and I just went along with it.
That's amazing.
A film well worth watching, though. A Shane Meadows Disney film's got to be somewhere.
Yeah,
an alternate universe.
That's one thing, like with TV commercials, because I know you've said to us in the past that you've done them, and I think I've seen a couple of them. But like, because of your style of working, Shane, I imagine like I couldn't imagine what it must be like on a commercial, because I've done them myself, and they're so like quick and they're so shiny and they need to be so perfect. Whereas your style of working's like, obviously speaking from experiences, we've gone into a room before and we've sat and rehearsed for 2 hours before the cameramen are even been allowed into the room, because like the way you work, everything's got to be spot on and everything's got to be truthful and everything's got to be real. So it's like, I think just the idea of you doing a commercial is a bit like,
it's Tom. It's like a real, it was, you know, and it was greed, I suppose, really, because I didn't, you know, I wasn't not eating. I just, you know, I remember getting into motorbike, you know, because I'm in my early 20s and you're sort of thinking, oh, you know, lusting over the fastest. I mean, I've not had a motorbike for 10 years, 15 years, since I had kids, really. And you kind of, yeah, but when I went to, I mean, I remember doing, this pattern starts to emerge. It's like anything, like you're in a relationship with somebody and you get back together, and then the thing that started to piss you off pisses you off a bit quicker this time, and then 3 months you break up, then a month, then a week, and then you think, I do one more day of this and, you know, I'm gonna have a mental health breakdown. And that kind of happened a bit within this, because what would go on is they'd hire you. And you'd, you know, you'd have a meeting with people and you'd say, you know, why was it you were thinking of me for this and that? And it all sounded completely normal. We've got kids in it. We've seen what you did in Romeo Brass, or what you do with newcomers, you know, what you've done in This Is England. We want you to, you know, adverts, they all say the same thing. You know, adverts feel very staged, very formulaic, and we want this to be different. And the first time you do that, you think that's the case. I mean, the first commercial I ever made was a baptism of fire, the like of which you wouldn't believe. It was all over the country in about 15 different locations. So right from the cliffs of Dover to the highlands of Scotland. So if you're going to not really be getting on with someone or not enjoying yourself and you're trapped on a minibus doing that, it's going to reveal itself quite quickly. And it's not these guys' fault, but it was their first job. It was my first job. So there was these senior partners. And Tom, if you've done an advert, you'll know there's about 3,000 layers and levels.
Yeah.
And you walk into other rooms where you're shooting and there's another set of monitors and you're like, who are they? And they're
it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And so we went on this job and I quickly realized the guys who were the senior guys, no matter what me and the junior guys agree, the senior guys are obviously making all the decisions and you can see that that's going on. So if the junior guys want to have 4 hours with you after a really long day, you start to think, oh God, you know, I don't want to do this because I know ultimately no matter what we agree, it's not going to happen. And that first, we did a cut of that advert, and I won't talk about each advert by name or anything, but I did a cut. And me and the junior dudes watched it and they said, look, that's never seen a first cut. That's brilliant. It's so good. Never seen one that good. I said, well, you know, the editor did it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And said, but all we need to do is just show the senior guys and then that'll be it. You know, you've got our thing, you know, our word, it's done. And the senior guys came in and I'm not joking. It was just like that. Brilliant. you know, that little tiny bit towards the end where, you know, where he's, I don't know, he's crossing over from this part of the country to that part of the country. Do you think you could put this on? And then this string started getting tugged at 42 cuts later. I mean, not like simple cuts. I mean, as in 42 completely different adverts changed and thrown around later. I just said, I rang the woman who I was doing it for. I said, I've done 42 cuts. I don't even know what my name is. Am I allowed to leave, or what's the rules now? Are people allowed to beat me up? You know, what can they get for their money? And she said, well, if you've done 42 cuts, I think you've probably, you know, what you do is put your director's cut forward. And then, long story short, I left that first cut. I said, the one I remember being good was the first one. And obviously you do with it what you want. And they went back to the first cut about 3.5 years later after arguing about it for ages. And I should have known then that it wasn't for me. But like I say, especially at the very, very beginning, it was just a means to an end, a way to be able to go into restaurants and eat posh cottage pie and buy things I never would have got. But yeah, if you've done them, Tom, I mean, and the great thing of it, it's like having a hangover. No one feels sorry for you. Like on an advert, I'm not going to feel sorry for you. You just got paid loads of cash. It's your own fault. So it's no one's fault but my own. But yeah, the one me and Mark did topped that one. I definitely made a few too many.
Is there any that you've made that you do really like though? Because I know of a few of the commercials. Obviously, like you say, don't want to name them out, but like that are really good, and you can tell it's kind of your style on them.
Yeah, the ones. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think any of them are awful. I just think it's that thing of what you get. What you think you're going to be able to bring to it, you can't bring to it. So it's not like they're awful. The experiences weren't so good. But the one that I really, really loved doing, really enjoyed and stand by, where I was given free rein, where I did, I can't remember how long ago it would be now, but I did some for the co-op. I did a film called Summer's Town with Tomo through Greg Nugent, who was looking after all the kind of publicity for the opening of the Eurostar at St. Pancras. And he gave, you know, me, Tomo, you know, Fraser. We, that was a brilliant shoot, Tomo, wasn't it?
Oh, it was so, so good. It was like, because it was only quick, wasn't it? It was only, what was it, 10 days we were shooting?
Yeah, it was only meant to be, wow. It was a 26-page script, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And but then,
in true fashion, we ended up shooting so much, didn't we? That was so good. That actually, I haven't actually sat and watched that for years. But it was a great little shoot, that. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was magic. And the guy that did that come back to me a number of years later, and he'd stood by his word when we did that, because I was kind of like, look, if the money behind it is coming from a kind of ad agency perspective, I've got all of these fears that I won't be able to make it. I don't mind putting my name to an advert, because, you know, your name's not on an advert, and you can kind of, if you're not that keen on it, or it doesn't turn out, or you don't think it's as good as you could have made it, no worries. But with it being a film, and it Fraser's script, and working with Tomo particularly, you know, actors who you massively respect, I was thinking, God, you know, I was worried, and I didn't need to be worried. And so when Greg came back with co-op and said, they've got this idea for you to go to the centres that they support around the country that you think, you know, that speak to you, it was almost, that was the last thing I made. It was almost like the first one, where I travelled the country, but on this one I actually did some films and made some films that I think are really not special, because that sounds a bit egotistical, but I think that they're me, and I was allowed to kind of be myself on them, and I'm really, really proud of them. You know, I'm hoping at some point to get some shorts and things thrown up on the internet, and if I was putting them up, I'd put them alongside with it, because we were given complete carte blanche with that, and you know, it was an amazing experience.
Well, yeah, you know, we was texting about it the other day, Shane, just quickly. You know, the Made of Stone documentary that you made. But you said that because you'd never seen the Stone Roses, had you, until that first time was in Warrington, was it?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I'd never seen them, and because obviously by the time I was in a position where I maybe could have afforded to travel to see them, they weren't together anymore.
So the whole experience of filming that must have been a massive treat for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that sometimes you pinch yourself. I mean, I went from, I think we just had this lovely thing happen where about I'd met Ian Brown at Banksy, had an exhibition in Bristol, And I went down to this exhibition with my wife, and there were some absolutely incredible people there, you know, a who's who's of kind of heroes of mine. And Ian Brown was there. And, you know, it's that thing where you don't want to be someone that goes up and introduces someone. You know, it's like walking up to someone and having a dinner in a restaurant or something. He was there for something else. But I just did that thing that people do. And you suppose you have to, because you might never see that person again. And I went up and sort of said, you know, I'm so sorry, I'm a big, massive fan, blah, 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 you know, and I told him my name, and he recognised the name. He said, you didn't do Dead Man's Shoes, did you? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, God, all the boys on the tour bus were hassling me to watch that a few months ago, and I sat and watched it. He said, oh, it's a banger, you know. And we ended up having a brilliant chat, and it was like my life was made on that day, you know, just from meeting him and talking to him. But maybe 6 months later, I don't know whether it was my agent, Dean Rogers, I can't think about it. There was like three or four people that got in touch with me and said, I've had a message for someone who knows Ian Brown, or Ian Brown himself's trying to get hold of your number. And so I got this text of his number and made this phone call. And then I got this news, which was almost like a poison chalice in a way, because I was going to have to hold it for 3 months before I could even say anything. So whatever it was. And Ian said, you know, me and the band are getting back together. And we sat and said, because they'd had a rough time with the press, awful, you know. So, you know, if it was now, it would be even worse. But every it's a bit like Oasis, the Gallagher brothers, everything they did was on the news, you know, you couldn't hide from anything. And they said, you know, we shouldn't really do a doc, it'll just be a pain in the arse. And then I don't know what my name must have come up in there. And there was this, because there was a mixture between Man City fans, Man U fans, they never agree on anything, but they all agreed to at least see me. And they rang me, and I got in touch with Mark, and I sort of said, you know, this is going to be the hardest thing in the world, because you are literally the one person in the world I know couldn't keep a secret if you tried, but you now have to. And we locked, I don't know, a week after that, of knowing that we're getting back together, I got another call saying, we want you to come to the rehearsal room to meet everyone, see what we think, no commitments either way. Me and Mark locked the final episode of This Is England 88 in London, came up in a van, picked up a camera, and then the opening scene to the film where we're sort of driving into the into that place, it was all captured live. And I remember saying to Mark, if we get to go in and hear one song and they hate us, or they don't think it's going to work, I will have seen them live. And I think when we came in, they were doing Bye Bye Bad Man and running it round, and we walked in, and Ian like motioned his finger for me and Mark to come and sit on a sofa next to him. Honestly, it was like, I felt like an 8-year-old kid, you know, seeing Palais or something. It was unbelievable. And I sat there, and you're trying to be cool, and you're trying to not be a massive moron. it blew my mind. And I sat there and I watched that. And I remember thinking, if nothing else comes of it, then this would be worth it.
Oh, mate. Yeah, I texted you the day, didn't I? And just said that I'd rewatched it. And it's like, as a fan of the Stone Roses and a fan of your work, it's like, it's such a good film. So if there is anyone that's listening that hasn't seen it, then who's a fan of, you know, Shane's work or the Roses, then you should definitely go watch it. But
thanks, T.
Yeah, so, so 100%. Good.
And like I say, I think the best thing about it is that we get to see you. We get to see the documentary filmmaker just being excited about it and stuff.
It's still to the day is one of the best nights of my life, was the Manchester premiere of that film.
Oh, such that was amazing.
A good night. So yeah. so good.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, it was brilliant. But I reckon that's about it. How long have we got there, Andy? Is that
we're on like 49 minutes. So yeah, that's
sorry mate, go on.
Unless you wanted to talk about your last one, Shane, which I think, because I was a bit confused, because I know you've got a fair few, and I know Tomo's got like his whole body covered, or did have at one point, was sleeve tattoos.
Yeah, I've got nothing against tattoos at all. The thing that I don't like now, because when I was a kid growing up, tattoos were like a sign of a sort of, you know, in my dad's generation, you know, my dad was a Hell's Angel. He had all these, you know, really sort of raw rock tattoos, Elvis tattoos, skulls, all of that sort of stuff. And there was this sort of almost like a navy quality to some of those. That, you know, they were uber cool. You know, my mum's mum and dad hated the fact he'd got them and all of that now. And when you go down to, you know, to buy a latte, or, you know, you go to an estate agent, pops round, or fucking anybody now has designed their own sleeve with things that mean something to them, like the Star of Capricorn, the day that Neil kissed fucking Lucy. And I see these things that they're designing. And because I was thinking of having some more tattoos, and I've realised now I'm the renegade because I've got bare arms at the bottom. So I've got, because someone like Joe Gilgun, who's covered in them, his tattoos are amazing because they're not, they're from the heart. And same with Tomo, you know, you've got some good ones, you've got some wank ones on your arse. And it's like where someone has kind of, it was around that time that people started growing beards, shaving their hair really tight, and then the jeans
that
went
sort
up
of
a bit
hipster,
too tight. Isn't
it? That sort of everyone's become a hipster nowadays, aren't they?
Yeah. And it was like, and I started seeing these ones, and you'd kind of look at them, and you know, because some people have the most amazing cool sleeves. It's not sleeves per se. It's a bit like, you know, you see a bodybuilder with a really titchy head that doesn't look right on its head. You kind of, you go, that's that's not the body you were meant to have, but you've given yourself something. And it's like the same with the arms. You know, I see an arm and I just kind of go, you're not meant to have that study of Picasso and fucking, you know, Charlie Dimmock on your arm.
That's the thing with tattoos is sometimes people... people really rush into them, and I've got friends who have got loads of tattoos. And I remember I was driving. I can't remember where we was going. But anyway, I was driving along, and my mate said to me, he said, "Oh," he said, "I've got a full day of tattooing booked in on Monday." This was on a Saturday, so in 2 days' time, he said, "I've got a full day of tattooing booked," and I'm like, "Oh, sweet." He said, "I said, what are you getting?" He said, "Oh, I'm going to get my leg done. I'm going to get my whole leg done." And I was like, "Oh, buzzing, mate. What are you going to get?" And he was like, "Well, I don't really know yet." And it's like, "Well, in 2 days." You're going to put some on your body that's going to be there forever. And I guess
it's
like
crazy.
Like what Shane just said, I've got a lot of tattoos, but all of my silly tattoos are in a place that no one would ever see. You know, the only time that I've ever got that out now is, you know, when I'm in the shower or whatever. So no one really sees all my bad tattoos, but you know, I've got tattoos.
Did you get your ass out on Alan Carr?
Yeah, that was years ago. That was years ago. Come on. That was when I was a fame-hungry idiot. But now I'm like, okay, think about things a bit more now. But no, but like a lot of my tattoos, every one that you'll see all means something to me. You know, I've got the one
absolutely.
Across my chest that's for my mom, and then I've got the nice one on my leg that I've got done. So they all mean something to me. But nowadays, kids are just rushing into getting these tattoos that just mean nothing to them, do you know what I mean? And it's kind
of it's like a fashion accessory. I think you see some people that are covered and it looks incredible, and you know it's part of their identity, and every single needle hole in there means something. And then other people, it's like they've just thrown on some, you know, designer jeans or something. It's just
like putting a watch on.
Yeah, no, you know, obviously each to their own and stuff like that, but it's in that camp of, like, you know, parents' voices at the park with kids. There's something about it that, and you know, that just makes me feel a bit sick. But but like I say, I just when I kind of grew up, we were doing them on each other down the park and all of that. So obviously, it's great that people are having them all done in proper places. But there's something that's depowered them. I think it all started with Beckham, and I'm Beckham's biggest fan. But I think him having them made them cool to a lot of people that would never have thought about doing it.
Yeah, definitely. Go on. I was going to say, like, because obviously I've got the one tattoo, which is the cross, obviously.
You got the cross that, on your finger from the film, didn't
you? You know, that, because I remember when we went back to do 86, and I wanted to do it. Like, I'd wanted to do it since we did the film. I always talked about getting it done, and then you kind of said, oh, yeah, you should go and get them done and stuff. And it's something that means so much to me. I couldn't imagine just getting like a fucking, I don't know, a football or something just down on my back.
Just getting a big football on your back.
A tin of Westler
hot dogs. What's that?
A tin of Westler hot dogs or something.
Yeah, but people do, you know. I bet that's not the most ridiculous one. And people got your face tattooed on them, Tomo. You've sent me pictures of people.
Come on,
with
mate, that's not ridiculous. I'm a British icon. This is England's a British iconic film. Yeah. Come on,
pick on something worth picking on.
Yeah, I know, but people, I guess, are kind of like, because This Is England meant so much to some people, then that's kind of like, you know, people are sort of proud to be British and whatnot. So I guess that's kind of, but I mean, when I was a kid, I've had it covered now, but I got
I tattooed an Adidas Originals logo onto my ankle. Can you remember that?
Yes, I certainly do.
Yeah, oh yeah, because you had to get makeup artists to cover it, I guess.
That's right.
Sorry, go on.
You all turned up in between series, like you'd go away from This Is England 86 to 88. Woody was the best. He'd come back with like postcodes on his arms that weren't there the year.
he literally got a postcode on his arm, didn't he? But
And that's the thing I love about Joe, because his, you know, they weren't like designer classics. There were things that it was his nan's postcode. And it's like, what a beautiful idea. If you looked at it on a bush, you'd think, what on earth is that? But when you actually asked him what it meant something. And that's kind of, yeah, that was beautiful. But it wasn't beautiful for the makeup people, because you all were evolving, you know, and having tattoos of things that obviously didn't exist in 1988.
Yeah, God, I remember when I had to cover my leg one up when we was doing the infamous masturbation scene in 88, that one. And
Smell, I think it. Yeah, it is. It's the Christmas one, because you're in the play and that, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it's when Sean creeps off to knock one out. I remember that being a massive issue, because the one on my legs literally like my whole calf pretty much. So it's a bit of a pain in the ass. But the one thing my dad always did say to me when I was a kid was when I got my first tattoo, because my first tattoo was my mum's name. I just got Sharon on my arm in really small writing, just on my shoulder. And I remember I used to walk around like with my sleeve rolled up a little bit to like, because I think I was only 17 or something, 17, 18. So I used to think I was really cool with this little tattoo on my arm. Mm-hmm. And now thinking back about it, I'm like, oh, that's quite embarrassing. But my dad always said to me, he said, if you want to get tattoos, I can't stop you, because he got a lot. Similar to your dad, Shane.
Yeah, he was exactly.
He's got all of the old school tattoos, but he always made me promising that I'd never get any on my hands or face. So it was really difficult because we was all together when you got the cross tattooed on your finger, weren't we, Andy?
Did
it in Sheffield, didn't we?
Yeah, I remember that.
And I remember thinking, oh, I really want to do it. I really want to do it. But in respect to my dad, I was like, he did always make me promise never to get it, because he always thinks, say if we're at a wedding or if we're at a funeral or a christening or anywhere you've got to wear a suit, he said, you can put a suit on and no one will ever know you've got any tattoos. So I always had to respect that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that, mate. You know, the cross thing was, I suppose, because I'd put that on me as a kid, and then because Combo was putting it on to you, there was something iconic. It, for whatever reason, it became something that we all identified with. And everyone sort of, I can't remember what era was it, Gads, when people all had the tattoo? It wasn't after the film, was it? Was it on one of the series?
It was 86. When we were rehearsing that week of rehearsals and that for 86.
Yeah, because if I see you guys and look down and see it, I feel a special, certain kind of pride.
Yeah, well, that's it, because to me, because obviously it's a crucifix, but I'm an atheist, but to me that's a T for This Is England, and it's something that completely changed my life, I guess. So
yeah, me
that
too.
That means you know, more to me than any, you know, other daft tattoo you can get.
Yeah, it's a lovely tattoo, and it is nice to know that. You know, the amount of people that have come up to me in the streets on nights out and things, and they've all had the cross tattooed on the fingers. It's kind of like, I guess for you, Shane, it must be, it's kind of like, it's really humbling. Even for me, you know, it's kind of nice that people have been so attached to what we made. It's like...
Yeah, it is. It's lovely, because every time someone asks you, when are you going to do another one, you know, I never get tired of being asked that question, because it means that obviously... People, if people want more of something, it means you've done your job properly, doesn't it? So it's, you know, and especially because it was, you know, obviously initially when I wrote it, it was kind of about me growing up in the 80s. But I think all of us, as it pulled us all along, everyone, there's a piece of all of our childhoods in there, isn't there? You know, and that's probably why it's special. And I've never, and I never would rule out, it's a bit like Ross and Rachel on Friends. It's never off the table, another This Is England. Mm. So, you know, you can't... you can't ever rule it out, because there's something about the fact that we've all grown up together somehow in there that I'd love to go back at some point, and I'm hoping you guys would as well.
Yeah, of course. Someone mentioned something the other day, though. Someone said, because we've all grown up now, and you know, like when we was doing 86, 88 and 90, we sort of like, it was part of the parcel where we was all out all the time. And then that sort of like, that become part of it. Whereas now, as nearly 30 year old, and I kind of like, I kind of take my job a little bit more serious now. So if I've got work the day after, I wouldn't dream of being in Viper rooms until 6 a.m. knowing that I've got a full day at work. And I kind of think, I wonder what that would be like on set if we went back and did another This Is England, where we're not all out, all, you know, we're all on FaceTime and in bed by 10 o'clock. I think
it'd probably be the most boring thing in the world, wouldn't it? Like, and you lot, you know, because obviously on the original film, you had chaperones, you were taught lessons in the day. So when we did 86, I'm not surprised the floodgates opened a bit for you lot. And it'd be interesting, wouldn't it, if we all went back and it was as dull as dishwater.
It's but then I think with the way that we all are, I think give it a day or two and then it'd be like, oh, actually no, I think it's part of the job, that, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Just all of us having fun together, and because we've all known each other for so long, I guess it's kind of like, within a day it'd feel like we never really left, you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, it would be. It's a summer holiday. I think whenever we go back to it, I think it's waiting for us. That you can actually, I know you probably didn't realize it at the time, but you can go out like I did with Mark and have 3 pints and go home and still be busy. No, I'm going to work.
Yeah. You do what?
Yeah. Oh, God. Some of those times, because when we all did 86, we all shared apartments, didn't we? And you was in there as well, weren't you, Shane?
I was, Tomo, yeah.
Do we have to go there, guys?
Oh, God. Some of the things that sort of come across. That was bizarre.
In my dreams, I was like, the things that went on, you know. But it was just, you hadn't had a chance to do any of that on the film, and then you obviously went back, parted, and had the crack. And the mistake that was made was me thinking, whatever age I was, a 35-year-old man, could sort of be living up the corridor from his cast. It was the worst idea I'd ever had. But
I think you are right there, though, Shane, because like I remember that very, very first night in the flats, and we were all in that, was it Michael Socker who had the balcony room?
Yeah.
And it literally, you could have sat there with a camera and it would have just been a scene out of, it would have been a party scene out of the series, wouldn't it? Like, we all just kind of, not reverted into the characters, but it was just crazy, wasn't it? You had Joe Gilgan saying, you know, as he does, just telling mad stories. And you know, I think I was like comatosed on the bed at one point, really drunk.
Shimmy had his pads out trying to fight everyone.
Yeah.
Wrestling days were amazing when we used to put those big coats on. You used to put a massive ski jacket on, and Roman Greco wrestled Shimmy. And you all had guns as well. Do you remember that, when you all had...
Yeah.
I found mine the other day. I was clearing out the house and I found my big shotgun. It's huge.
Oh, God.
And there's a way you can pump it and it fires like 7 bullets at the same time.
Oh,
it's
my
like,
good
the,
God.
The best memory of that was, I remember walking into Joe Gilgan's flat. I think I must have needed some milk or something. And I went upstairs to nick some off him. And as I walked through his front door, I got shot in the shin by about 4 different BB guns from a shotgun. Joe was lay on his bedroom floor with the door open and he just went 2 hours. I went, what? He went, I've been lay here for 2 hours waiting for someone to come in.
Oh my
and
God.
He completely just shot me in my shin. And I believe that he was there for 2 hours as well with Joe.
You remember the one where you started punching each other in the undercarriage?
Oh, yeah.
I can remember that. Because I remember there was this thing where you'd be stood. You had to be at your most innocent and most vulnerable. So you might be talking to costume or makeup, and then someone would sneak up behind you, go underneath you, and hit you as hard as they could. Private section. And then you called a truce. I don't know whether you signed a treaty.
An amnesty. Like, we had an amnesty zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you had an amnesty zone. And it was down to things like when you were ordering food in takeaways, and, you know, whenever someone was. The amnesty kicked in, and you broke the amnesty, Tomo, didn't you?
I fully broke it, yeah. Joe was ordering a Chinese, and I, Joe Gilgan, who played Woody, and I hit him so hard in the balls, he was spewing up all the way back. We was walking up this hill, and it took us about 20 minutes, but he was sort of like... He was spewing up so much, but it was making me laugh. I was crying and like snot coming out my nose. And I thought, oh yeah, that was one of the funniest things ever. And I remember for days and days, like I was saying to, like, I'd creep into makeup in the morning and I'd be like to Catherine, I'd say, has anyone seen Joe? Is he still angry? is he still pissed off at me? Like, I need to know what's going to go on. But in the end, he just he froze a pair of my trainers. I bought a brand new pair of Nikes, and I went into my flat one day to put them on, and I couldn't find them. And I said, has anyone seen my Nikes? And then I asked Joe, and he like, have a look in your freezer. So I went and
do you remember how we got him back, though?
No.
Me and you Googled best pranks to play. And we went upstairs and got some cling film and put it around his toilet seat. So basically, Shane, the idea is Joe would go for a pee, not see the cling film, and pee everywhere. But Vicky went on his toilet before he could. Oh. So Vicky ended up just covered in piss.
Oh, jeez, dude. Yeah.
Oh, it's some of the greatest times. Brilliant. Yeah, such a good laugh that we have on that, isn't it?
Magic. Absolutely magic, mate.
Yeah. It is a summer holiday, like you say, I think.
Yeah. I'm sure we've got one more in us, but who knows?
Oh, we'll see. Well, I think we can end it on that note. Thanks so much for doing it, Shane. I know obviously like you say you're busy writing and stuff, but
thank you very much, mate. Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Personally, I don't see his problem with big tattoos. Do you know what I mean? The problem is, let me show you this, actually. We can get in on that.
Go on.
If you look close enough here, you can see his name.
Have you actually got a show? Oh, yeah.
I've got his name tattooed on me, so take it back.
Show everybody my name tattooed on you.
No, I've grown up now. I don't like getting them out.
No, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Because obviously Shane's like got nothing against tattoos, as he says, but it's those that, you know, I guess are just meaningless, pointless tattoos, isn't it? Is what he says. And well, I've seen your leg in IRL in real life, and you've got stuff there that means a lot to you. Your angel on your chest, do you know what I mean? Each one of your tattoos mean a lot to you.
That's 80% of them do mean something.
80%? What are
80% of them, because I've got quite a lot of shit ones that I got when I was a kid that I thought was funny and I thought was a good idea. What? But then as you grow up, I would like now, because for people who are listening who don't know, I've got loads of names on my ass, and Andy Ellis is one of them. I've got Vicky McClure, Joe Gilgan. I've got all of the cast of This Is England. And when I was 18, I thought, that's a good idea. But now, like, exactly like Shimmy always says, oh, show me your ass. I'm like, I'm nearly 30 now, Shim. I don't want to be getting my ass out and smoking.
Nobody wants to see it at 30.
You know what I mean? So it's a prime example, like, rushing into tattoos, getting them when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And not thinking about it. And my dad said that to me. He said, He said, first of all, you're a fucking idiot. But he's got bad tattoos as well. But he said, you'll get to a certain age, Tomo, and you'll regret them. And I said, not that I regret them, but I do think that was a stupid idea.
It's a part of your life, isn't it, at the end of the day? I'm a big believer in, like, not really... I mean, I don't have any regrets in anything that I've ever done. And I think it's got to be that way, like, you know. And with your tattoos, yeah, they're with you forever, but that's not you anymore, and that's just a part of your life.
I mean, you can get a new wife, can't you? But you can't get rid of tattoos, so...
Well, you can, because...
Just thinking of big regrets in my life, that's all, mate. Sorry. Sorry, Charlotte! No, you have. You've just got to think about it, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, if there is younger listeners out there, obviously they're going to be probably doing the same as what you did when your dad told you. They're going to be saying, "Shut the fuck up, Tomo, you old bugger."
Yeah,
I'll do what I want. But yeah, that's part of being young, I guess, isn't it? And like Shane said himself, you know, like obviously we've got that because Shane's got that. Some of us from from This Is England have, you know,
the ones who struggle to let it go. That's what I like to think. The ones who struggle to let it go got the tattoo on the fingers, but that's fine. That's a different conversation for a different day, isn't it?
Just Lex making.
Just one more This Is England.
Obviously, for those who paid attention and listened there, Shane all but confirmed another one. So.
Yeah.
How can we let it go, Tomo, when we keep getting pulled back?
Well, that's it, mate. I'm on Sky One now, though. I don't think he can afford me. No.
Oh, I'm on the dole. He can afford me.
No, which is exciting, though, because it's one of them, innit, sort of. Particularly when we was kids and we knew that Shane was going to make more. It's like, when's that phone going to ring? Like, when are we going to go back? Yeah. When are we off on holiday? It's like waiting to go on holiday, isn't it? It's like, when are we off back on holiday?
That's it. I think he said in the podcast, didn't he? It's like a summer holiday to him when we do it. And it is like, I mean, you know, we touched on it in the chat there, but like, there's no other job like it. And that's not just us saying that as that wankery actor thing, that wankery actors say, like, oh no, there's no job like this. Genuinely. Like, look at me and you now, like, I consider you one of my oldest, dearest friends.
Mate, I've known you and Shim and Soccer and all them lot longer than I've known any of my mates, I think.
Yeah.
Longer than I've known any of my mates.
Really?
Yeah, literally. Because I sort of hung around with a group of people when I was younger and then moved to a different estate.
Yeah.
After I'd done the film and never really saw many. I mean, I still see a few of them, like, but not. I see you a lot more than I see any of my other mates. So.
Oh, wow.
It's nice that... It's nice that it spawned that sort of relationship, and it's like for friends for life. Because when you're on a set, you do say to people a lot, oh, we'll stay in touch. And you do for a while. And then, you know, sometimes because life gets in the way, so you can sort of drift apart, can't you? But
that's it. You know, and people are busy and stuff. And yeah, you're right. Like, you know, I can probably count on one hand the amount of people I've probably stayed in touch with from other jobs. You know,
actors are fucking wankers anyway, aren't they?
Yeah.
The wankers. I don't like staying in touch with him. Everyone was saying to me when I got married, oh, who's any celebrities coming to your wedding? I was like, no.
No.
I hate him.
But yeah, no, I mean, yeah, you know, such a good podcast and amazing to have Shane on because, you know, that man, without again sounding cheesy and that, like, changed our lives, gave us such a good opportunity. And now we've repaid him by giving him, you know, such a good opportunity to come on such an esteemed podcast.
Well, there we go. We was in charge of this one.
Yeah,
he was on our show this time.
Yeah, so it's on our terms, do you know what I mean?
I mean, we're in charge here.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah, another wicked episode. Thank you very much again, everyone, for listening. Hopefully we'll get some news on Thursday about what's going to happen again with this bloody lockdown, but I hope everyone's staying safe and staying well. And
yeah, likewise, same for me. I hope everyone's doing well and try and remember to do a bit of exercise and cook some nice food, do some baking, anything to keep you busy, really. That's what's helping me. But again, if you can all like, subscribe, you know, tell your friends that we're now on YouTube. Obviously, some of the guests are not able to do the video chats, but 90% of them are. So it's just a different platform for us as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. But obviously, get on the YouTube, like, subscribe, all that stuff. We've got the Patreon there as well, if you can. Obviously, times are shit right now, but if you can, like me and Tomo said, anything while the lockdown's on that we do make, that's going straight to any charities that we sort of think need the help, really. We want to try and do our bit, I guess. Patreon.com/overrated everything. Another one down, Tomo. Episode 6 next week.
See you all next week.
See you next week.